This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. From time to time, we're lucky to talk on the phone with Mort Marcus, who is a noted Indiana economist, used to be on the faculty of IU in Bloomington in the Department of Economics, Business School, I guess, with Kelly School of Business, really. And he's, of course, noted writer and speaker as well. For folks that remember when he made the rounds with his fellow economists from Bloomington, he would come around and do what they call the roadshow. And in fact, he made many trips up to Northwest Indiana, particularly to stop at Teeble's for have a chance to have a nice meal and That's talk right. with people. And he's done that for a while, and he's back up here in the region for visits. And we thank you for stopping in the studio today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to visit with you.
Well, it's fun to do in person as we do it. We have fun on the phone when we do it when you're in Indianapolis and we're up here in the region. But it's nice to have you here in the studio about this and talk about your Eye on the Pie columns that are out there to see and read for yourself. And the latest column. Well, you mentioned about fictional characters. Yeah, there are some that you mentioned and you've seen before. Some of the people that you like, I think, that are like your alter egos, I believe, in some cases.
Well, what I try to do is introduce something that makes it a little bit easier. Many people have difficulty with economics, and mm-hmm. they have difficulty with numbers. And I've talked to journalism students and others and said, if you can't see people at the checkout, when you see retail sales figures, if you can't understand that people are pushing their carts around the grocery store and that they're going to be paying a sales tax, you're focusing on the tree. And what bothers me in part of even about NPR these days mm-hmm. is so much of our stories have to have an introduction about a single person. It's as though we can't relate to people in large groups. And I think there's something wrong with reporting things that way. You know, tell me about the unemployment rate. Tell me how many people are involved. And then if you want to put your sob story in, put your sob story in. But give me the basic information. And so I try to put some people in there mm-hmm. Because I recognize that's what folks are comfortable with. But this latest column that I put out, I put our two dogs in.
Yeah.
Fergus and Harrison. Fergus is a small dog. He's about 15 pounds. And we call him Nervous Fergus because he's very edgy, and he can't stand fireworks. Mm-hmm. We try not to be up here around the 4th of July. We tend to be in Indianapolis over the 4th of July. Well,
you probably hear enough of those down there as it is.
Not as bad as here.
Oh, okay.
Not as bad as here.
Well, that's because we're so close to Chicago. You can buy them, you know.
Well, you can buy them, but we just have a lot of irresponsible people in our neighborhood out in Miller. Mm-hmm. And what I think is important is to recognize that both of them have problems. Fergus, as I said, is nervous. Harrison only has three legs. Mm-hmm. He's a big dog. He's 60-some-odd pounds. And it got me to thinking about how well they get along. And they even get along with the cats. And yet, here we are, a country that is dividing itself constantly, being vicious to each other. And I just don't see why that's the case. We have lots of people in our families, on my wife's side, on my side, who have disabilities of one sort or another. Some they were born with, others they picked up along the way. Every family that I know of has difficulties of some sort or another. And we've got to learn to be much more accepting of people, not hide them away. We've seen situations where families actually hide their children from visitors because they're somehow, I don't know whether they're ashamed or what the issue is, but there's a tendency to segregate and to separate people with disabilities. And yet we have found that when we make accommodations for people with disabilities, we do great things for other people. Let me just give you a simple example.
Okay.
Federal government came in and said, we're going to change sidewalks. We're going to make it so that you can roll down from the sidewalk to the street. And we've done that with sidewalks all across America. And I have seen how wonderful that is for people who are pushing baby carriages. I've seen how wonderful it is for people who are bringing home the groceries in a cart, and bicyclists, and kids on tricycles, and things like that. Those ramps, which were made for wheelchairs, are really beneficial for all of us. And there are other things. The having words on television screens so that you can read what the announcers or what the actors are saying, was done originally for the hearing impaired. Well, it turns out my wife and I are not hearing impaired. Of course, she claims that I am, and I claim she is. But basically, it's a value because you're able to see what the words are, and sometimes you will miss something, or an actor or an announcer will drop a voice at the end of a sentence, and it's garbled a little bit.
Right.
So things that we do for those who are, quote, disabled, work out for our advantage. And I think this is also true if we get around to really resolving some of the racial issues in this country. What we'll find is that the general population benefits when we help those who have been, in a way, disabled by society. And I think that's going to be a very important aspect of people talk about reparations, but we're really providing reparations in a way for our entire society when we provide reparations for people who have been disabled by our practices.
One of the other Eye on the Pie columns that just came out recently, during this month actually, is again one of these opportunities to use a fictional character to try to explain something. As you mentioned, some little difficult part to understand in economics, and it's for the column, which is entitled "How much would your house rent for?"
Which is an
interesting question anyway, because you never stop to think about that. If you own your home, you never think about that. But it's interesting to think about that. And you mentioned a local angle to this. It's more than just looking at census figures, I guess.
That's right. There are two points to be made here. The first one is that we hear a lot about per capita personal income. Every governor that I know of in the United States is talking about, we're going to raise per capita personal income. Well, 8% or more of income is what they call the imputed rent on your home. That is, what would your home rent for if you didn't own it and if you rented it out? Well, I looked at some figures, and it's not science. It's rough. I don't know what to call it. It's juggling with numbers when you really can't juggle at all. But that's what we're doing. What if I found is that rents in Gary are higher than in 46 other cities in the state relative to the value of the housing that they're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Zionsville, which is a very wealthy suburb of Indianapolis, northwest, it's in Boone County, in Zionsville, the rents relative to the value of the property are very low. And what this means is that the tenants in Zionsville are getting all of the benefits that come from living in this high-income community. Wonderful shopping opportunities, tremendously convenient transportation, whereas the people who are living in Gary do not have those benefits, and that's reflected in the value of the property. The properties are low valued because most people don't have good shopping opportunities in Gary. Most people can hardly find a drugstore in Gary any longer. And what we're seeing is a situation where the landlords are getting a very high rent relative to the value of the property that they own. I don't know whether we can call it an injustice. I don't know if we can call it an inequity, but it's something that is what really needs to be done in Gary and similar cities all across the country, and there are similar cities across the country to Gary, when it's not a unique place. What we need to do is we need to find ways to increase land values. We need to make Gary a place that people want to go to and are willing to pay higher prices for the land. One of the very best measures of economic development that we don't use is what's happening to the value of the land in that place, because the land doesn't move. People move, but the land doesn't move. How much are people willing to pay to be in Munster versus being in Gary, to be in Ann Arbor, Michigan versus being in Flint, Michigan? And land values are one of the fastest ways of seeing what a community is doing. If the land values are not rising relative to other values, what we're finding is that we're not really getting the economic development that we think we are. And we spend a lot of money in this state and in this country on economic development, and a lot of it isn't paying off.
We're talking with Indiana economist and lecturer and writer Morton Marcus. He talks with us on Time to Time about the Eye on the Pie columns that are out there. You've just talked about, in this case, about land value. There's another column, too, that talks about economics. And here, again, you're trying to make sense of it and make it easy for the average person to understand. And it's dealing in particular with the GDP, which we talked about before.
Oh, yes.
About the gross national product, domestic product, rather.
Right.
And the column is interesting to figure out where can you make sense of it and bring that information home. Can you tell us a little bit more about that column?
Well, what we have is a very standard situation where GDP measures our economic activity, and it doesn't measure things that aren't in the marketplace. And what is one of the most valuable things that we have? Raising a child? Well, we only see that in the marketplace if you put your child in a nursery school or a daycare or something of that sort. Making a home, cleaning a home, taking care of, making it a place that your family wants to come to and where relationships are good. That's not in the marketplace. And what has happened in this country and is happening around the world is so much of the things that we used to do at home, that we used to do for ourselves, we now go out and we're in the marketplace. And let me give you just two simple examples on that. One is when my wife and I got married, we had a lot of books. We were students. I made bookcases. We went to the lumber yard, bought some wood, got some nails, hammers, didn't really know how to make a bookcase, but they stood up for years and years until our boys were old enough to climb on them, and that was the end of the bookcases. Today, if I want a bookcase, I go to Home Depot or Lowe's or Menards, and it's all folded down into a box, and maybe I have to put two thumbtacks in the back of it to make it firm. But it's a wonderful bookcase, and that's in the marketplace. That's in GDP. But when I made the bookcase at home, that wasn't in GDP.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have is the things we do at home are not valued in GDP, and there's a great deal of concern about getting those things in there. One is to recognize the value that the homemaker has in our society. And I keep trying to use gender-neutral terms because when my first grandchild was born, my son took care of her, kept the house clean, made the dinners because his wife could earn more than he could. Mm-hmm. And since they had an infant, one of them should stay home, he did that for 2 years until she was old enough to be taken care of by her grandmother, which is another situation. But taking care of a child is one of the most important things that we do. When you go to work, you tend to eat out more. So what we've seen is restaurants growing and burgeoning all over the place. And that's valued. But if you cook a great meal at home, it's not in GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing is GDP growing because we're shifting more and more to the marketplace. But we never put a value on what we've left behind. And somehow, we've got to start doing that. And it's sort of like the rental value of your home. What's the value of that meal that you cooked for yourself?
Well, that's interesting. Interesting point. And it's interesting the way the column brings it up as well, too. One other column we have to talk about, and our great, as you mentioned, our great apologies to Rod Serling, is what you like to entitle the economic zone, and which is, I think, we're always in.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's interesting where you try to make sense of it as well, too.
Well, economics is to me a fascinating field because it's an attempt to understand the daily things that we do and how they relate to each other. It's important to be able to say, as I've asked fourth grade students very often, take your shoes off. Now, teachers don't like it when I say take your shoes off. But I want them to take their shoes off and to look inside and see if they can find a place where it says where they were made. And depending on the year, they were either made in Korea or they were made in Taiwan or they're made in China or they're made in Bangladesh or someplace like that. And then I ask the students to go up to the map on the wall and find that place and get an idea of how far away that is from wherever I am that day. What I want them to do is I want them to realize, how did my shoes get here from that faraway place? How did my shoes get here? And think about the boat that brought your shoes over here. Think about the truck that brought the shoes to your town. Think about the store that had the shoes when you wanted to buy them and they were there. And think about the fact that your mother or your father or your grandfather, your grandmother, your uncle, whoever it was, took you to the store and paid for that. Where'd they get the money to do that? And those are the things that I think are important, these linkages of how we're involved with the rest of the world and how we are able to have shoes. Then we get to the question of the cell phone. And we get to the question of all the things that children are growing up with. It's amazing to see children around age 1.5 or 2 with tablets and playing games on their tablets. They and their parents have to understand this incredible, as we call them, supply chains that link this little child in a grocery store, sitting in the cart, playing with a tablet, mm-hmm. to the fact that tablet has come from some other place, but it may have been designed by Americans. And to understand all these complex linkages that work in our world.
Let's close this one out for today, Morton, with one column which is entitled, Where Do We Shop? Which may seem like a rather dumb question to ask, but no, there's some thought behind it. Where do we shop, I suppose?
Well, one of the things that is most amazing about retail trade, and we don't think about this very much, is that if you think about a store, a retail establishment, as the Census Bureau likes to call them, two-thirds of them have no employees. It's just the owner, maybe the owner's family in there, and they're really small stores. My wife loves to go to junk shops. Mm-hmm. She calls them antique stores, but she likes to go to junk stores. And what you find there is generally the proprietor and they may have goods in there and that people have brought in and maybe sold to the shop, or they put in there in the hope that they will sell, and then the shop gets a commission off of the sale.
Right.
That's a typical store, and we have so many of these places that two-thirds of all of the retail stores in the state of Indiana are of this nature. They don't have employees. It's the owner, and that's it. We tend to think of the big places that we go, and we talk about shopping, and we talk about Meijer and Strachan Van Til and Costco and so many others that are large places that have many people coming in. Some of these shops may not see a customer for days, and you wonder how they survive. I certainly wonder how they survive. They do survive, and part of it is that they're run by people who just enjoy doing what they're doing. And the fact that they're not making a lot of money, and the fact that they are easily closed down by their own illness — they don't have to have a pandemic, but they can be closed down by their own illness. Very often they're not open. I remember walking around the square in Frankfort, Indiana, just east of Lafayette, on a Tuesday morning, and not a single shop was open. It was after 9 o'clock. It was about 10 or 15 minutes after 9 o'clock, and many of them had signs in the window said open at 9. They weren't open. Why weren't they open? Because for one reason or another, a Rotary Club meeting ran long, or the car didn't start, or they had sniffles and didn't want to come to work that day. Whatever it was, there wasn't a single store open around the square in Frankfort on that particular day. And you can't hold it against these people because they're not open. We have the expectation in America that if a place says it's open at 9 o'clock, it better be open at 9 o'clock. Because right. If I get there at 9:01, I'm going to get mad about this because I've had to wait a minute. But America and Indiana still has a lot of small townness to it, where we don't have large organizations. We don't have businesses that are run by the clock. We have businesses that are run by human beings. So when you think about a retail establishment, you're thinking about something that is quite different from where most people are going most days. But out there also are all these small businesses. And that's one of the reasons that the administration and the Congress, Democrats and Republicans, are so concerned about small business, because small businesses create, in a way, the distinctiveness of a community. Almost every community has a McDonald's, a Burger King, a Chick-fil-A. I used to say to my students, "Where do you come from?" First day of class, and a student would say, "Terre Haute." And I said, "Well, when you get there, how do you know you're there? What is it?" Because as you get off the interstate highway, what you see is what you can see in almost any town, almost all across this country. There's a Holiday Inn and there's a McDonald's and such. What makes something distinctive are the small shops that you won't find someplace else, because nobody else is doing this. And it's amazing to see how some of these small retailers are adapting to this new world. I have a man over in Winchester, Indiana, which is on the far east side of the state, over near Richmond, close to the Ohio border. He ran a men's haberdashery store. Well, just the words are old-fashioned. Men's clothing is what he had. And his business was just going down the tubes because men were not buying suits any longer, and they were not wearing $50 and $80 pairs of shoes. They were wearing sneakers, and this is you know, except for going to a funeral, this is how people were dressing. And the store was going under. And he started selling scuba equipment and scuba suits, diving suits and masks and such over the internet.
Uh-huh.
And the business stayed alive.
Well,
the business stayed alive. You can still go in there and buy a tie. Half of the store is stocked like a haberdashery store. And I have sort of a sensitive spot for that because my great-grandfather owned one of those shops in Mobile, Alabama during the Civil War. And after the Civil War, the whole family moved north. That's how I got my Brooklyn accent. But the point is that these small shops are the things that make places different. And I think they're an important part of our society, and I'm glad to see that the politicians recognize that.
Well, it shows that the phrase "shop local" is more than just a Chamber of Commerce slogan.
That's
to
right.
To be sure, it's very important.
That's
so,
right.
And it's always important to have a chance to talk with you, Morton. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
Morton Marcus is an Indiana economist and a speaker and writer, and he's been here in the studio with us here on Regionally Speaking. Indiana University Northwest has a new chancellor. In fact, he is taking officially his job on August 1st. We are talking now with Professor Ken Iwama, who has come to IU Northwest, to the Gary campus, as the new chancellor for IU Northwest from a position in New York State, in fact, in New York City. Welcome to the region, Chancellor Iwama.
Thank you, Chris. Interestingly, you're a familiar voice to me. You're probably one of the first voices from the Northwest region that I actually heard. When I was applying for this job and going through the search process, I inadvertently or accidentally or whatever, had done a search and came across your broadcast talking to the search chair of the committee, and
that's right.
And towards the end, they were mentioning my name, so it was a little surrealistic. So you and your show were probably one of my first introductions to the Northwest region. So I feel like I'm among familiar voices.
Well, if folks don't remember that was back in February. That was pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
I should say pre-shutdown, and that was when you and your other finalists had come to campus to meet with a number of people. It probably seemed like a cast of thousands, I'm sure,
for a while. It felt that way at some point.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that, and when you came up here to do the, I guess it's a very interesting way to do a job interview by committee, literally by committee. That had to be something of, although I'm sure you've gone through it before because you've worked in other places. We should mention here at the outset that you've come to Northwest Indiana from, as we mentioned, from New York, from a position on the administration with the City University of New York, College of Staten Island. And now, for anybody that knows New York City, knows about the boroughs, they probably know more about the Bronx and Brooklyn and Manhattan. They probably know about Staten Island, but probably figure it's unoccupied, uninhabited. But that's not the case, is it? There are a lot of people there. In fact, there's a university campus there, too.
Absolutely. And I'll talk about the process in a second, but since you mentioned Staten Island, when people mention New York City, I think everybody gravitates to what the Manhattan skyline and Times Square, because as visitors to New York City, that's where everyone gravitates. And now maybe some Brooklyn, parts of Brooklyn and Queens and Bronx as they're starting to have their pockets of rejuvenation and development. But you're right, in terms of Staten Island, it has a history of being much different in terms of demographic, in terms of land, in terms of development than the rest of the cities. In fact, one of the things that are somewhat similar between Staten Island and the Northwest region is that it really, Staten Island is more of like a suburb. It used to be cows and farmland and horses, because the only way you could get to Staten Island from the other boroughs was by ferry before the Verrazano Bridge was built.
Yeah.
So it's still difficult to get to Staten Island. So it is really an island with an island. So I appreciate you pointing that out, because I think the misconception is whenever I say I work for the City University in New York, I came from New York City, they think I'm on Fifth Avenue somewhere with taxis and traffic. But really, it's more of a serene suburban part of the city that I come from.
I suppose that when you were up here in Northwest Indiana, along with the other finalists who had applied for the position of IU Northwest Chancellor and had a chance to talk with them, and they asked questions, of course, about your background, which we've kind of done in our conversation just now, but they probably bring up the fact, you know, well, you're probably used to all the noise and everything of New York City, certainly of the metro area, and say, what, you know, how are you going to be able to cope get yourself acclimated to Northwest Indiana? What did you happen to tell them?
Well, the first thing I tell them is that, you know, I work in New York City. I work on Staten Island, but actually I lived in the Jersey Shore, the New Jersey Shore.
Right.
And so I commuted every day into the city like many people from New Jersey. So I am a person who really was a shore kid, a Jersey Shore kid, grew up on the ocean. And it's a more laid-back atmosphere, and, you know, it's a place where everyone goes to vacation. So, you know, experiencing that and that type of lifestyle, that type of experience, you know, when I first took a look and saw and visited the South Shore of Lake Michigan, the Miller Beach and Ogden Dunes area, I can't tell you how at home I felt.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Lake Michigan, which I'm not really that knowledgeable of the Great Lakes and the expanse of the lakes, and when I saw Lake Michigan, I said, "Well, you know, this looks like the Atlantic Ocean on a calm day."
Well, and you're not the first person. You're not the first person to mention that when they get the first look at Lake Michigan from the shore, they look out there and all they see is water. And,
yeah, it was really amazing. Yeah. So my wife and I say, "Well, we already feel right at home." It's fascinating, Chris, because, you know, when you look on the shore and you see Chicago, you know, now jump back to New Jersey and the shores of in the Jersey Shore, and you see that same image of Manhattan. It is really uncanny, the similarities of being, you know, in the glow of one of the great cities of our nation, both in New York and in Chicago. So, again, the more I explored about the Northwest region, the more similarities I found between our areas, both in terms of location and feel and in terms of people as well, too.
One of the previous experiences in higher education, actually was before higher education, it was working as a counsel for a Jersey school board, and I'm sure that you had that was your opportunity to learn something about local politics and certainly about local education, and do you think that there is a lot that you can apply to that over time and right now to taking over as IU Northwest Chancellor?
Well, you know, my experience in pre-K through 12 education, and you're right, they're perhaps, especially in the Northeast, I don't know as much in the Northwest region yet, I will,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, school boards and public education in New York, New Jersey are some of the most political creatures that you could imagine, bureaucratic and political. So I did learn, I cut my teeth in that environment, learning about how bureaucracies and politics and how to navigate that landscape to, at the end of the day, benefit the students, which is why I'm chancellor here at IU Northwest. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, you keep talking, we talk about parallels. You know, the school district I work for, which was the Jersey City Public School District, the second largest school district in the state of New Jersey. At one time, we had a close to 40,000 students, 6,000 employees. It was a massive, massive organization. But we had the dubious distinction before I came to Jersey City as being the first school district in the nation to be taken over by the state. And
mm-hmm.
I know there are some really parallels here for the Gary school system as well, too.
That's
so
right.
I am well-versed in that dynamic as well, too, in terms of struggling schools and the resources they need to succeed and that integration into higher education as well, too. So I think my experience is well-suited for all the dynamics that I'll face in the Northwest region.
When you were up here for your interview and your visit with the other finalists and talking with the committee that was doing the interviewing at the time, I'm sure they wanted to know what your expectations for IU Northwest were. And even though you were just familiar briefly at the time with the system, what did you tell them that you wanted to do if you would be chancellor? Now that you are chancellor of IU Northwest, what are your intentions, even though the coronavirus pandemic is still locking things down for the most part. What do you still hope to be able to do as the new leader at IU Northwest?
Well, you know, first of all, I do have to put a shout out and a thank you to, Chancellor Lowe, William Lowe, who has guided, with his steady hand, guided the campus for over a decade, and as well as the faculty, staff, and students who have really created this incredible foundation, this credible academic foundation at IU Northwest. And immediately that was one of the attractions that I had to IU Northwest in deciding whether to apply here. But in terms of what I see is in terms of visioning and possible accomplishments that we can make together, you know, when I look at a university and a higher education institution, I look for, first of all, their core academic excellence. And at IU Northwest, we have that. We have the great faculty, their research scholarship, their performing and creative arts. It's there. So as part of that foundation, I was excited to see the incredible intellectual capacity of IU Northwest. The second aspect of what I think the incredible plus value of higher education institutions is taking that energy and then integrating it with the community. And so I know we already have a robust community engagement at Indiana University Northwest. But I have to tell you, I come from a background, and what I've accomplished at the College of Staten Island is really taking that core academic energy of faculty, staff, and students, and really creating these reciprocal partnerships with our community. That, you know, that old term, you know, with the tide, all boats rise. Well, you know, if you pick the right partners and the right collaborations, you know, whatever you bring out to the community comes back to the university tenfold. And that has been my experience at the College of Staten Island. Many of the things that we have done at the College of Staten Island have brought actually millions of dollars back to the community from the state and from federal resources. So I am looking to be able to tap this energy to organically find those connections and collaborations with our community partners and really just help everyone in the process, and I'm excited to do that.
Now, I know that the fall semester 2020 for IU Northwest is going to get underway on August 24th, and I guess I have to ask, are you ready for the combination of in-person, face-to-face, and virtual and online coursework that the students who come back to the Gary campus in one way or another will be facing?
Well, you know, it's been a strange transition in a good way. As you had mentioned at the onset of this interview, that I take effect in terms of my role August 1st, which is a Saturday, and really roll up my sleeves and really start getting into work August 3rd, which is on Monday. But and I say this has been an odd transition, but a helpful one. It's been unique. In normal times, when you're a chancellor or president taking over a new position, right? You being from out of the state, I probably would have flown in a couple of times and met with the staff, and that would have been it. And then August 3rd, I would have jumped in and had to learn everything. The strange dynamic about coronavirus and everything now being virtual is that has actually helped me in terms of my transition. I've had over about 100 meetings, both with colleagues in IU Bloomington, as well as locally here with my new colleagues at Indiana University Northwest with Chancellor Lowe. So normally, where I may have just met people once, I've had multiple biweekly meetings with everyone. So I feel much more prepared, actually, stepping into this role on August 1st. And so now getting back to your original question about the coronavirus and our preparations, I've been involved with the last month or two in all the discussions about, returning to fall semester during the time of the coronavirus and this public health pandemic. And so I have to tell you, IU Northwest has done a remarkable job in preparing the campus and its students for reentry and restart. I've been able to participate in many of the restart committees and many of the town halls that to answer questions both the faculty, staff, and students have about returning and preparation for returning. And I just have to look at the numbers, Chris. We have 41% of our classes are completely online, right? Mm-hmm. Meeting the needs of social distancing. And we also have another 49% of our classes, which are some version of online. It's more of a hybrid model. So between the two modalities, you know, we're probably 90% some type of online. So that's how quickly IU Northwest, its faculty, staff, and students have been able to transition to a new type of fall semester. And so it's a credit to the people that are here.
Well, Chancellor Iwama, I have to ask this question as we kind of wrap things up for this conversation, which we hope is just the start of many. When you came in to talk with your boss, President McRobbie, did you get to do it in Gary, or did you have to travel down to Bloomington to do it? And what did you talk about? What did he ask of you?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, too, because I made it just under the deadlines regarding the coronavirus sheltering in Indiana. So I was able to have a fully personalized experience. And if we have a little time, let me get back. This kind of harkens back to your original question about the process. You know, when I first came for my airport interview, they called it an airport, and I think Susan Scalmi-Giuseppe had spoken to an interview about the process. And,
yes.
You know, our first interview is always at the in Chicago O'Hare Airport. You don't even get to visit the campus. So actually what I did is I rented a car before that interview, and I thought it was necessary to visit the campus. I was in to visit Gary and to drive around Gary in the Northwest region, because how do you apply for a job and with a straight face and say you want to be the leader of this institution if you haven't even visited the community? So the day I flew in, the day before, I walked around campus anonymously. I drove around the Gary area and a little bit around the surrounding Northwest region, so I get a feel of the locality and the community. And then, like you said, right after that, I actually got to come to campus, you know, not virtually, in person, before all the lockdowns happened. And like you said, meet these marathon sessions, which, you know, I think I had over 14 meetings with campus members in the community in a span of 2 days. So it was exhausting but exhilarating at the same time. So then I was able to come back and to follow up your question about meeting President McRobbie, I was actually able to have those in-person meetings with my colleagues in IU Bloomington, and certainly one of the final meetings with President McRobbie. And and if I could characterize that meeting, it's really talking his really explaining to me really the elevation, the resurgence of the regional campuses, right, and the importance that they play within Indiana University. So, you know, everybody knows about IU Bloomington, IUPUI, but the regional campuses have really been able to establish their identity in terms of how they service each local region, and that was music to my ears, because, you know, part of the, when I see about you know, the billboard saying, you know, this is the region's university, Indiana University Northwest, that harkens back to my work at higher education, which is really establishing universities and anchor institutions, supporting their regional communities, you know, both in terms of socioeconomic, in terms of jobs, in terms of procurement, in terms of being in a place where students can change their lives, and where it could be performing in cultural arts centers. So all of the things that President McRobbie was saying to me about where we have come in terms of the regional campuses and where we are going, again, that aligned exactly with my skill set and what I want to do and continue to do at Indiana University Northwest.
Kenny Walla is the new chancellor for IU Northwest. He officially starts his job this weekend, but in turn he will start his job in the office on campus on Monday. And Chancellor Iwama, thank you for spending your time with us. Welcome to the region. Welcome to Lakeshore Public Radio. And thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Chris, and thanks for the welcome.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. On the program tomorrow, we will introduce you to another author. Sam Love is actually an editor of the book that is entitled The Gary Anthology that is coming out. We'll find out more about that. And we'll have Selena Weatherwax with the Macmillan Foundation talking about the First Responder Appreciation and Demonstration Day. Hope you can join us.